along with the tumor. After his surgery, running was too demanding. Occasionally, I would see Brad riding his bicycle on campus, and I gave silent thanks each time I did. One of the most celebrated statements in clinical medicine comes from a lecture delivered by Dr. Francis Weld Peabody of Harvard Medical School in 1925. The secret of the care of the patient is in caring for the patient. This is undoubtedly true, but less obvious than it may seem. Peabody cautioned doctors about the way their training conditions them. Of necessity, we learn to suppress our emotions, to block our natural reactions to many of the awful things we see and the brutal things we must do. Consider what happens in the ER when we try to save the life of a person smashed by a car or burned in a fire. If a doctor thought too much about the person before him, he couldn't insert his gloved hands into a hemorrhaging abdomen or maneuver a breathing tube past charred flesh. Even in less desperate circumstances, giving chemotherapy to a young woman with widespread breast cancer, say, or inserting a dialysis shunt into the arm of a blind diabetic whose kidneys have failed, we have to detach ourselves from anguish that could impede our work. But to become immune to feeling, as Peabody indicated, is to diminish the full role of the physician as a healer, and relegate him to a single dimension of his job, that of a tactician. If we feel our emotions deeply, we risk recoiling or breaking down. If we erase our emotions, however, we fail to care for the patient. We face a paradox. Feeling prevents us from being blind to our patient's soul, but risks blinding us to what is wrong with him. I asked Dr. Karen Delgado about this paradox. Delgado is an acclaimed specialist in endocrinology and metabolism at a large urban teaching hospital who cares for patients with hormonal and metabolic disorders such as diabetes, infertility, and hypothyroidism. To my mind, she is the very model of a doctor, deeply knowledgeable about medical science and compassionate, empathetic, and generous with her patients. When I asked Delgado whether she had ever made an attribution error, she readily recalled a patient from her training in the 1970s. A young man was brought to the emergency ward of the hospital in the wee hours. The police had found him sleeping on the steps of a local art museum. He was unshaven, his clothes were dirty, and he was uncooperative, unwilling to rouse himself and respond with any clarity to the triage nurse's questions. Dr. Delgado was busy that night attending to other patients, so she eyeballed him and decided that he could stay on a gurney in the corridor, another homeless hippie who would be given breakfast in the morning and returned to the streets. Some hours later, she felt a nurse tugging at her sleeve. "I really want you to go back and examine that guy," the nurse said. Delgado was reluctant, but she had learned to respect an ER nurse who felt that something was really wrong with a patient. "His blood sugar was sky high," Delgado told me. The young man was on the brink of a diabetic coma. He had fallen asleep near the art museum because he was weak and lethargic and unable to make it back to his apartment. It turned out that he was not a vagrant, but a student, and his difficulties giving the police and the triage nurse information reflected the metabolic changes that typify out-of-control diabetes. "The hardest thing about being a doctor," Delgado said, "is that you learn best from your mistakes, mistakes made on living people." Chastened by the experience, she conjured up the picture of that young man whenever she was called to the ER to evaluate other disheveled and uncooperative people. But, Delgado continued, that was a single experience corresponding to a single stereotype. "It is impossible to catalog all of the stereotypes that you carry in your mind," she said, "or to consistently recognize that you are fitting the individual before you into a stereotypical mold. but you don't want to have to make a mistake to learn with each stereotype. Rather, Delgado believes, patients and their families should be aware that a doctor relies on pattern recognition in his work and, understandably, draws on stereotypes to make decisions. With that knowledge, they can help him avoid attribution errors. "Is this really possible?" I asked. "Sure. It's not easy for lay people to do," Delgado said, "because patients and their families are especially reluctant to question a doctor's thinking when their questioning suggests his thinking is colored by personal prejudice or bias. Still, Delgado thinks lay people can diplomatically direct a doctor's attention to his reliance on stereotypes, because one of her patients had done this with her." Ellen Barnett had recently sought out Dr. Delgado for help with a multitude of vexing symptoms. Many people who see Delgado have symptoms that are difficult to pin down. Low energy, for example, or abrupt weight gain, and assume they have a hormonal or metabolic imbalance. Usually they don't. Ellen Barnett had already consulted 5 physicians and felt all 5 had shunned her. "I'm having what I call explosions, feeling hot all over, which makes my skin crawl. I mean really crawl, like ants all over, and sometimes they come with terrible headaches," she told Delgado. "Really, it's like a bomb going off in my body. I know I am in menopause, and all 5 doctors told me that that's the cause of my problems. And 2 told me that I'm crazy. And frankly, I am a little crazy," Barnett said with a wry smile. "Okay, I know menopausal women have hot flashes, but I think this is something else, that what I'm feeling is more than just menopause." As Delgado listened, she recognized how easy it would be to make an attribution error with a persistently complaining, melodramatic menopausal woman who quite accurately describes herself as kooky. So she stopped herself from casting Ellen Barnett as a stereotype, and assumed for a minute that her patient was telling her something important, something meaningful, that these explosions were indeed different from run-of-the-mill menopausal hot flashes and hormonal migraines. "I evaluated her very extensively," Delgado said, "and it turned out that, yes, she was menopausal, and yes, she was a strange person with lots of weird ideas. But what turned up in her urine was not from menopause or being kooky. Her catecholamine levels were through the roof. A CT scan showed a pheochromocytoma above her left kidney." A pheochromocytoma is a relatively rare endocrine tumor that produces catecholamines, chemicals like adrenaline that can cause wild swings in blood flow and blood pressure. The changes in circulation may mimic menopausal hot flashes and precipitate severe migraine-like headaches. The catecholamines can also cause psychological symptoms such as anxiety, despair, and even aggression. If untreated, the patient may have a stroke or heart or kidney failure. She had surgery and the tumor was removed. Now her hot flashes are much less severe, as are her headaches, at the level you would expect during menopause, Delgado said. But Ellen is still kooky, by her own admission. Delgado believes that patients or family members can adopt Ellen Barnett's approach. With a disarming sense of humor, she communicated that she understood she fit a certain social stereotype, and that stereotype had caused her doctors to fail to fully consider her complaints. "I didn't feel like Ellen was being obnoxious or patronizing," Delgado said, "and I didn't react and become alienated or annoyed with her. What she said enhanced her credibility and helped me avoid an attribution error." Negative feelings that patients like Ellen Barnett trigger in a physician are usually close to the surface. But positive feelings, like the ones Cross-Gary had for Evan McKinley, Falchuk had for Joe Stern, and I had for Brad Miller, are more difficult to recognize as dangerous. Since Delgado is a physician who has genuine affection for many of her patients, I asked whether she had ever fallen into that trap, the trap of affective error. She thought she had. I had an elderly patient with thyroid cancer and considered treating him with radioactive iodine. There are difficult logistics involved with the therapy, and it really can disrupt the person's life. I was just about to refrain from treating this man when he said to me, "Don't save me from an unpleasant test just because we're friends." At best, in severe circumstances, the family or friends of patients who realize that a doctor's affection may stay his hand at times can address this concern by saying, "You should know how deeply we appreciate how much care you show. Please know also that we understand you may need to do things that cause discomfort or pain." Only a layman, aware of how such feelings can color a doctor's judgment in subtle but significant ways, could make such a remark. In pondering Delgado's vignette, I realized it would have been impossible for Brad Miller to muster the energy to think about our prior interactions and warn me this way when I saw him that morning on rounds. It was my job to be complete in my exam, and my charge to monitor my feelings when they might break my discipline. Patients and their loved ones swim together with physicians in a sea of feelings. Each needs to keep an eye on a neutral shore where flags are planted to warn of perilous emotional currents. Chapter 3. Spinning Plates. Tuba City, Arizona, lies 3,246 miles west of Halifax, Nova Scotia. Halifax was the first British town in Canada, founded in 1749. Most of its 360,000 inhabitants still trace their roots to the British Isles. Tuba City has a population of just 6,000, but it serves as the central town for more than 100,000 members of the Navajo and Hopi nations. Modern glass and steel skyscrapers ring the Halifax harbor, and a sharp northern light reflects off the sea. Tuba City sits on high mesa, the surrounding country highlighted by scrub and the soft pastels of ancient sedimentary rock. Halifax's Dalhousie University Medical School is renowned for its academic departments and cadres of researchers. The hospital in Tuba City is a cluster of low-slung, dun-colored buildings housing the Indian Health Service. The nearest MRI scanner is an hour's drive away. Despite these differences in geography, size, resources, and culture, an emergency room physician in Tuba City, like Dr. Harrison Alter, has to recognize the same clinical patterns and avoid the same cognitive errors as a counterpart in Halifax like Pat Crosscarry. Alter, who is 43, did not initially see himself as a physician. He studied comparative literature at Brown, and only 4 years later attended medical school at the University of California at Berkeley. Following his residency at Highland Hospital in Oakland, he went to the University of Washington in Seattle as a Robert Wood Johnson Scholar to study medical decision-making. After 2 years on the faculty at UW, he wanted to work with dedicated doctors in an underserved community. So he moved with his wife and three young children to a small yellow stucco house in Tuba City. One day in April 2003, while Alter was working in the emergency department, an ambulance brought in a 10-year-old boy named Nathan Talumpkiwa from the local Hopi school. The fourth graders had just ended recess and were lining up to return to class when another student jumped on his back, expecting a piggyback ride. Nathan was a hefty boy, 4 feet 8 inches tall and 140 pounds, and reveled in rough-and-tumble play. But this time he screamed in pain and fell to the ground. Nathan came in on a backboard in full spinal immobilization, Alter recalled, describing how a patient is kept in a fixed supine position to prevent any stress on potentially injured nerves. He was terrified, sobbing and moaning. Alter quickly took the history and asked Nathan several key questions. He said that he could move his arms and legs, that there was no tingling or electric shocks going down his spine or into his buttocks, only that he had this terrible pain in the middle of his back. Alter concluded that it was safe to move the child off the backboard onto a bed. When Alter examined him and pressed on the lower thoracic spine, Nathan cried out. I sent him off for x-rays, and sure enough, right at the tender spot, he had a wedge compression fracture of the 10th thoracic vertebra. This was a 10-year-old boy with the kind of fracture that I am accustomed to seeing in an 80-year-old woman. And I thought to myself, this just isn't supposed to happen. Alter told me that with each patient he recites the ABCs he learned during his training. In fact, the alphabet of emergency care includes D and E as well. A stands for airway, meaning that the mouth, throat, trachea, and bronchi are all open. B is breathing, that the patient's lungs are able to get enough oxygen and pass it into the bloodstream. C is circulation, that the heart is pumping, the blood pressure is adequate for the blood to reach vital organs like the liver, kidneys, and brain. D stands for disability, a reminder to check neurological function, not only muscle strength and reflexes, but also mental responses. And finally, E is for exposure, not to neglect any part of the body just because you are focusing on a problem in one area. In Nathan's case, he concluded, each letter was satisfactory. Alter ordered tests, including a complete blood count, calcium level, and bone enzymes. All were normal. He then went further and got a CT scan, which was transmitted digitally to a bone radiologist at the University of Arizona. Shortly, a report came back to the emergency department. Normal, except for a compression fracture at the 10th thoracic vertebra. Alter still was uneasy. He put Nathan in an ambulance and transported him for an MRI scan to Flagstaff, an hour and a half away. Later that day, Alter learned that an MRI confirmed what the CT scan showed, the single collapsed vertebra and no other abnormalities. Alter called a local pediatrician. The specialist reassured him that nothing serious was going on, nothing to be concerned about. We just see this sometimes, the pediatrician assured him. I had to accept the data, Alter said, but still was worried. He made sure the pediatrician saw Nathan a few days later. At that appointment, Nathan was feeling better, with only minor discomfort in his back. The pediatrician told the family not to worry. It was just a freakish playground accident. In Seattle, Alter had been trained in Bayesian analysis, a mathematical approach to making decisions in the face of uncertainty. When he sees a patient, he calculates a numerical probability for each possible diagnosis. In Nathan's case, he was at a loss to assign such a probability. There simply was no database to refer to for a compression fracture of the 10th thoracic vertebra in an overweight but otherwise healthy 10-year-old Hopi boy. So Alter tried to approach the problem not by sophisticated mathematics, but by common sense. The event was nothing, Alter said. A student jumping on Nathan for a piggyback ride, and it didn't seem enough to explain the injury. But the pediatrician seemed to think looking for another answer was unnecessary. I was at a loss, Alter told me. This was a specialist talking to me. I should bow to his authority. I heard a familiar resonance in Nathan's story, not because I trained in emergency medicine or take care of children, but because I've heard specialists say, we see this sometimes. It has the ring of confidence, a statement based on long experience, and is meant to lift the burden of further investigation off everyone's shoulders. But it should be said only after an exhaustive search for an answer and ongoing monitoring of a patient. If said glibly, it shows worrisome ignorance instead of representing reassuring knowledge. It means that everyone should stop thinking. Alter had no choice but to move on. He had done the best he could, more than most would have done in evaluating Nathan. But he couldn't stop thinking about him. He was forced to wait until, in clinical jargon, the problem would declare itself. That declaration took place some weeks later when Nathan got out of bed and immediately collapsed in pain. He was rushed back to the ER. Alter examined him and confirmed that D was in order, that Nathan's legs were not weak and his reflexes were intact. He ordered another set of X-rays. Now there were 4 wedge fractures of the spine. Alter transferred Nathan to a hospital in Phoenix. An orthopedic surgeon there performed a bone biopsy and sent it to the pathology laboratory. Peering into the microscope, the pathologist in Phoenix saw sheets of large round cells inside the bone. Each cell resembled the next, dark blue with a convoluted nucleus. Special tests identified the enzymes within the cells and the proteins on their surface. The diagnosis soon was clear. Nathan had acute lymphoblastic leukemia. The leukemia had so weakened the vertebra that it had collapsed with a piggyback ride. Now the case made sense. As Alter had surmised, what the pediatrician had said did not. No one, no doctor, no patient, should ever accept, as a first answer to a serious event, "We see this sometimes," Alter said. When you hear that sentence, reply, "Let's keep looking until we figure out what is wrong or know the problem has passed." One winter day in the same year that Nathan Talumpkawa fell ill, a Navajo woman in her 60s named Blanche Begay came to the emergency department because she was having trouble breathing. Mrs. Begay was a compact woman with slate-gray hair gathered in a bun who worked in a grocery store on the reservation. Over the past few weeks, a nasty virus had been moving through the close-knit community, and scores of patients like Blanche Begay had come to the hospital with viral pneumonia. Mrs. Begay said that she first thought she had just a bad head cold. So she had drunk lots of orange juice and tea and taken a few aspirin. But the symptoms worsened, and now she felt terrible. Alter noted that she was running a low-grade fever, 100.2 degrees Fahrenheit, and her respiratory rate was almost twice normal. He examined her lungs and heard the air rapidly moving in and out, but none of the harsh sounds, called ronchi, that are caused by accumulated mucus. Alter obtained blood tests. Blanche Begay's white blood cell count was not elevated, but her electrolytes showed that the acid-base balance of her blood had tipped toward acid, not uncommon in someone with a major infection. Her chest X-ray did not show the characteristic white streaks of viral pneumonia. Alter made the diagnosis of subclinical viral pneumonia. He told Mrs. Begay that she was in the early stages of the infection, subclinical, so that the footprints of the microbe were not yet evident on her chest X-ray. Like many other patients with pneumonia whom he had seen recently, she should be admitted to the hospital and given intravenous fluids and medicine to keep her fever down. At her age, he said, viral pneumonia can tax the heart and sometimes cause it to fail. So it was prudent to keep her under observation. Alter handed off the case to an internist on the staff and began evaluating another patient, a middle-aged Navajo man who also had fever and shortness of breath. A few minutes later, the internist approached Alter and took him aside. "That's not a case of viral pneumonia," he said. "She has aspirin toxicity." Even years later, in retelling the story, Alter groaned. "Aspirin poisoning. Bread-and-butter toxicology," he said. "Something that was drilled into me throughout my training." She was an absolutely classic case. The rapid breathing, the shift in her blood electrolytes, and I missed it. I got cavalier. As there are classic clinical maladies, there are classic cognitive errors. Alter's misdiagnosis resulted from such an error, the use of a heuristic called availability. Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, psychologists from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, explored this shortcut in a seminal paper more than two decades ago. Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2002 for work illuminating the way certain patterns of thinking cause irrational decisions in the marketplace. Tversky certainly would have shared the prize had he not died an untimely death in 1996. Availability means the tendency to judge the likelihood of an event by the ease with which relevant examples come to mind. Alter's diagnosis of subclinical pneumonia was readily available to him because he had seen numerous cases of the infection over recent weeks. As in any environment, there is an ecology in medical clinics. For example, large numbers of patients who abuse alcohol populate inner-city hospitals like Cook County in Chicago, Highland in Oakland, or Bellevue in Manhattan. Over the course of a week, an intern in one of these hospitals may evaluate 10 trembling alcoholics, all of whom have DTs, delirium tremens, a violent shaking due to withdrawal. He will tend to judge it as highly likely that the 11th jittery alcoholic has DTs because it readily comes to mind, although there is a long list of diagnostic possibilities for uncontrolled shaking. DTs is the most available hypothesis based on his most recent experience. He is familiar with DTs, and that familiarity points his thinking that way. Alter experienced what might be called distorted pattern recognition, caused by the background ecology of Begay's case. Instead of integrating all the key information, he cherry-picked only a few features of her illness, her fever, her rapid breathing, and the shift in the acid-base balance in her blood. He rationalized the contradictory data, the absence of any streaking on the chest X-ray, the normal white blood cell count, as simply reflecting the earliest stage of an infection. In fact, these discrepancies should have signaled to him that his hypothesis was wrong. Such cognitive cherry-picking is termed confirmation bias. This fallacy, confirming what you expect to find by selectively accepting or ignoring information, follows what Tversky and Kahneman referred to as anchoring. Anchoring is a shortcut in thinking where a person doesn't consider multiple possibilities, but quickly and firmly latches onto a single one, sure that he has thrown his anchor down just where he needs to be. You look at your map, but your mind plays tricks on you. Confirmation bias. Because you see only the landmarks you expect to see, and neglect those that should tell you that in fact you're still at sea. Your skewed reading of the map confirms your mistaken assumption that you have reached your destination. Affective error resembles confirmation bias in selectively surveying the data. The former is driven by a wish for a certain outcome, the latter driven by the expectation that your initial diagnosis was correct, even if it was bad for the patient. After the internist made the correct diagnosis, Alter replayed in his mind his conversation with Blanche Begay. When he asked whether she had taken any medication, including over-the-counter drugs, she replied, "A few aspirin." He heard this as further evidence for his anchored assumption that she had a viral syndrome that began as a cold and now had blossomed into pneumonia. "I didn't define with her what 'a few' meant," Alter said. It turned out to be several dozen. The irony is that Alter had suspended judgment about Nathan Talumpkiwa's diagnosis, had not anchored his thinking at all, because he could not estimate a probability for a particular disease or identify a biological mechanism causing a vertebra to collapse. This had held him back from accepting the pediatrician's glib assurance. Yet, he jumped to a conclusion with Blanche Begay, assigning a probability of 100% to her case. "I learned from this to always hold back, to make sure that even when I think I have the answer, to generate a short list of alternatives. That simple strategy is one of the strongest safeguards against cognitive errors. Imagine that you are an emergency physician like Harrison Alter or Pat Crosscarry. In most instances, you don't know the patients you see. So you have to rely on a snapshot view of their illness. Unlike an internist in his office, who is familiar with his patients and their families, knows their character and their behavior, and can observe the evolution of a clinical problem over time. Imagine that it is a typically busy evening, and the triage nurse has assigned 3 patients to you over a half-hour period. Each patient has a host of complaints. Pat Crosscarry told me that, at moments like this, he feels as if he is plate-spinning on sticks, like a circus performer using sticks to spin plates without letting them slow down or fall. Actually, it's harder than spinning plates because plate spinning requires a single rotary motion and all the plates are of similar size and weight. Each patient, of course, is different. And for each, you may have to go through different motions quickly to reach a working diagnosis, treat any urgent problems, and then decide on the safest disposition. Admission to the hospital, transfer to another institution, or discharge to home. Now consider what you must do to meet these goals of diagnosis, treatment, and disposition. First, you have to figure out the main reason each patient has come for emergency care. While that may seem straightforward, it is not. Patients may give a triage nurse or a doctor a reason that is tangential to the real, more serious underlying problem. Or they may offer the symptoms that bother them most, but may be unrelated to their underlying disease. All doctors work under time constraints, and this is especially true in the emergency department. So, as we saw with Alter, the questions you choose to ask and how you ask them will shape the patient's answers and guide your thinking. You may go off on a tangent if you try to elicit a history too quickly, but you will neglect your other tasks if you take too long to hear what is wrong. I recall an elderly man who arrived at the ER complaining of pain in his ankle after tripping on the street. All he wanted was to be reassured it wasn't broken and be given a painkiller. Everyone focused on his ankle. No one thought about why he might have tripped. Only much later, we learned that he'd fallen because he was weak from an undiagnosed anemia. The cause of his anemia turned out to be colon cancer. To compound matters, patients may not remember key aspects of their past medical history. And without a hospital chart or office record, you lack any independent source to help fill in the gaps. This is especially true with regard to medications. I take a blue pill and a pink pill for my heart, a dizzy patient may say. But he doesn't recall the names and doses of the pills, and you are at a loss to assess whether his nausea and dizziness are related to his therapy. After you determine your patient's primary complaint, you must then decide what blood tests and x-rays to order, if any. Harrison Alter returned to Oakland's Highland Hospital after 3 years in Tuba City. He told me that he emphasizes to his interns and residents in the emergency department there that they should not order a test unless they know how that test performs in a patient with the condition they assume he has. That way they can properly weigh the result in their assessment. This is not as easy as it may sound. Take, for example, Pat Crosscarry's encounter with Evan McKinley, the forest ranger whose chest pain was not typical of angina. As Crosscarry's colleague pointed out, he went the extra mile in ordering tests on McKinley. Not only an EKG and a chest X-ray, but also a test for cardiac enzymes. For each, Crosscarry had to judge whether the result was normal, abnormal, or spurious. Laboratory, X-ray, and EKG technicians make mistakes. I recall when I incorrectly placed the EKG leads on a patient's chest, and, not realizing my mistake, concluded he had a serious problem with the electrical conduction pathways of his heart. He had no such thing. The EKG was an artifact generated by my mistake. Other errors can be more subtle, like taking a chest X-ray when the patient has not held his breath. This can cause white streaking in the lower lungs, a sign of pneumonia. For each patient, you are making scores of decisions about his symptoms, physical findings, blood tests, EKG, and X-rays. Now, multiply all of those decisions you made for each patient by 3 assigned in 30 minutes by the triage nurse. The total can reach several hundred. The circus performer spins only a handful of plates. A more accurate analogy might be to stacks of plates, one on top of another, and another, and another, all of different shapes and weights. Add to these factors the ecology of an emergency department, the number of people tugging at your sleeve, interrupting and distracting you with requests and demands as you spin your plates. And don't forget, you are in an era of managed care, with limited money. So you have to set priorities and allocate resources parsimoniously. It costs less if you can take several plates off their sticks, meaning if you limit testing and rapidly send the patient home. Perhaps you breathe a sigh of relief when the triage nurse sends you a patient you have seen before. People who repeatedly visit the emergency department are called frequent flyers. Instead of a single page of a new patient sheet, the frequent flyer has a hefty chart with ample past history and testing that would seem to simplify things. Except, of course, when it complicates them. Maxine Carlson was a single woman in her early 30s working as an office secretary in Halifax. 2 years earlier, she had developed sharp pains in her right lower abdomen. She told her primary care physician that it was different from the pain she had as a child with appendicitis or the postoperative pain of the appendectomy. The doctor examined her but found nothing of concern. Over the next few months, on some days Maxine Carlson was constipated, and on other days her bowel movements came with great urgency. Her doctor suggested she eat a more balanced diet, including fiber every day. But this had little effect on the pains. Maxine finally was referred to a gastroenterologist. At first, the specialist wondered whether she might have an inflammatory bowel disease like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's. But the doctor didn't find anything abnormal after an extensive evaluation that included numerous blood tests, X-rays, and both upper and lower endoscopy, which visualized her esophagus, stomach, duodenum, and colon. The gastroenterologist confirmed that she had irritable bowel syndrome and emphasized the importance of a high-fiber diet. A psychiatrist also evaluated her and prescribed anti-anxiety medications to relieve the stress that can exacerbate irritable bowel syndrome. A year after the onset of the sharp pains in her right abdomen, Maxine Carlson felt discomfort in her pelvis. At first, her primary care physician said it was just her irritable bowel disease, but Maxine insisted it was different, a squeezing, persistent ache rather than the familiar sharp, fleeting pains. She was referred to a gynecologist, who performed an internal examination and then ordered an ultrasound of her uterus and ovaries. He, too, found nothing abnormal. Maxine's pelvic aches waxed and waned and then eventually disappeared. Then, 2 weeks before she came to the emergency department, the regular pains in her right abdomen became more intense. It was August, and her primary care physician was away, so Maxine went to the hospital. The doctors in the emergency department had the 2 volumes of her medical records. They examined her, obtained blood tests, and told her that nothing was wrong. It was just a flare-up of her irritable bowel disorder. Dr. Pat Crosscarry was working in the emergency department when Maxine Carlson returned for the 3rd time in 7 days. The triage nurse was rolling her eyes when she told me about the case, Kroskary recalled. That this was a young woman with no tangible problem, that she had been worked up extensively by her primary care physician, her gastroenterologist, and her gynecologist, and she carried a functional diagnosis. The euphemism functional means psychosomatic in clinical medicine. She is really woolly, the nurse told Kroskary, and she won't stop coming in. It was very busy in the emergency department, and Kroskary was caring for several patients with urgent problems. When he finally entered Maxine's room, he saw how agitated and distraught she was. She bitterly complained that the pains just wouldn't go away. He found no new symptoms when he asked Maxine Carlson what prompted her visit that evening. As he examined her, he later told me, he felt consoled upon seeing the appendectomy scar, since Maxine's pain was in her right lower abdomen. I'm coming up with nothing, Kroskary told the triage nurse. Nonetheless, he said he was sending off blood and urine tests. This was met by considerable resistance. Why are you doing this? The nurse asked. She's already been worked up. Kroskary told me he felt palpable pressure because it was hectic in the emergency department and the nurse needed Maxine's bed for another patient. But he insisted. About an hour later, her test results were in hand, all normal. I reassured her that this seemed to be her irritable bowel acting up, Kroskary said. I went over again issues about proper diet and stress management. I also emphasized to her not to be reluctant to come back. Kroskary has learned from experience never to discourage patients from seeking follow-up care. She broke into tears, crying that no one believed her, that no one was able to come to a diagnosis, he recalled. She kept saying that the pain was getting worse, that it was much worse than it had been even a week before. How can you not be moved by a patient's tears? Kroskary asked me rhetorically. Still, he sent Maxine home. A short time later, she was rushed by ambulance back to the ER. She collapsed while walking home, Kroskary said. She was bleeding internally and on the verge of shock. She was rushed into the OR, where a surgeon found that Maxine had a ruptured ectopic pregnancy. It had been missed 3 times. I was the 3rd miss, Kroskary told me. Yes, Maxine Carlson did suffer from irritable bowel syndrome. She had been extensively evaluated by her many doctors. That evaluation had ultimately exhausted the options of her physicians, even the most astute, like Pat Kroskary. During my training, we used a euphemism, worked up the gazoo, to refer to a patient who had been examined by every conceivable specialist, had had every imaginable blood test, X-ray, and procedure, and there seemed to be nothing left to do for them. In Halifax ER parlance, Maxine Carlson had been worked up the yin-yang and then was out. The physician tells himself that he can't throw any light on the dark place where a diagnosis might be hiding, Kroskary said. You go through a checklist of all the avenues that have been explored, and it seems that each was a dead end. And you have no new direction to go in. Kroskary refers to the failure to think of a new direction, because you assume all have been explored, as the yin-yang-out mistake. The ecology of an emergency department includes not only patients, their families, and, of course, nurses, but also other doctors. At Highland Hospital not long ago, Alter was the attending physician when a resident in training evaluated a man in his 30s complaining of a sore throat. It's an open-and-shut case of strep, the resident told Alter, an uncomplicated patient. Alter had the sense that the resident wanted to move quickly to his next patient. Alter asked for details. He has an exudative pharyngitis, pus near the tonsils, and painful lymph nodes, the resident said. Alter insisted that he wanted to meet the man himself. The resident sighed in frustration. Alter peered into the patient's throat and saw no signs of pus. He ran his fingers along the sides of the man's neck and felt small, soft lymph nodes that were not tender. Alter pressed more firmly on them. Still no reaction from the patient. The resident had already given him a large dose of an antibiotic and a prescription for more. Alter led the resident into the corridor and told him that it didn't at all look like strep, that it was most certainly a virus causing the sore throat, and that prescribing antibiotics unnecessarily could have serious consequences. "Our hospital is overrun with MRSA," Alter told the resident, using the acronym for methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. "This type of staph infection has become the bane of modern medicine. It is the direct result of promiscuous prescribing of penicillin, and extremely difficult to eradicate." "I question the resident's automaticity," Alter said, "how he just wanted to dispose of the case, and the easiest way was to label it strep, give a slug of antibiotic, and be done with it." A short time later, another man came in with a sore throat. "Go to room 23 and start with the patient," Alter instructed the resident. After Alter had sutured the arm of a man with a knife wound, he made his way back to room 23. "He's fine," the resident said curtly. "Another one of your favorite viruses." Alter didn't just sign off on the resident's assessment. As he interviewed the patient, he saw that he was restless, moving around on the examining table, unable to find a comfortable position to rest his head. When Alter peered into his mouth, he saw nothing abnormal. The man was breathing easily, and there was no stridor, no harsh sounds suggesting an obstruction in the upper airway. But Alter was concerned about the patient's restlessness and his fever of 101 degrees Fahrenheit. He lingered a while, thinking. "Like I said, it's a viral pharyngitis. And at Highland Hospital, we don't give these people antibiotics," the resident said with dripping sarcasm. Alter ignored the baiting tone. He again moved his fingers down the sides of the man's neck, marching meticulously, this time pressing inch by inch. When he was about halfway down, the man winced in pain. "I want a CT scan of his neck," Alter told the resident. For a long moment, the junior doctor said nothing, but then he left and ordered the scan. The call later from the radiologist did not surprise Alter. The man had an abscess in his neck. "This is the kind of infection that can kill you," Alter said. "If it's not treated quickly with intravenous antibiotics, it can block the upper airway and you'll suffocate." There were 16 attending physicians and 40 residents working in the Highland Hospital Emergency Department at the time. Most of them were dedicated, serious, honest, and emotionally balanced. But not all. As Alter explained it to me, the residents' behavior was payback for the earlier criticism for prescribing antibiotics when they weren't appropriate. The resident wanted the second patient's diagnosis to be viral pharyngitis so he could needle Alter, and that desire led to an inadequate physical examination. That kind of incomplete care and immature acting out could have resulted in the man's death had Alter not been the kind of attending who double-checks everything the residents say and do. As in every place, ecology is determined in part by atmosphere. Here, the emotional temperature had risen dangerously high. Most people believe that decisions in the ER must be made instantly, but Alter said that is a misperception that we doctors, in part, foster. In order to think well, especially in hectic circumstances, you need to slow things down to avoid making cognitive errors. We like the image that we can handle whatever comes our way without having to think too hard about it. It's kind of a cowboy thing. As if being swift and decisive saves lives. But, as Alter put it, he works with studied calm, consciously slowing his thinking and his actions with each patient in order not to be distracted or pressed by the hectic and sometimes chaotic atmosphere. Alter also emphasized that laypeople should realize the limitations of emergency medicine and have realistic expectations. We are diagnosticians, but not comprehensive diagnosticians. Often, whatever is bothering a patient, it's flying below the level of our clinical radar. Like with Nathan, the last thing I want is a patient to leave the ER and say, "The doctor said there is nothing wrong with me." What we try to establish to our comfort and the patient's comfort is that what is bothering them is not going to kill them in the next 3 days. An ER doctor's studied calm should be apparent to a patient or his family. If the physician is distracted, frequently interrupted by other doctors, nurses, social workers, or the administrative staff as he interviews or examines you, the steady flow of his thinking may be diverted in the wrong direction. There is similar cause for concern if the physician seems rushed or breaks in as you answer a question, so that you feel he is not letting you tell him everything about your symptoms. Being quick and shooting from the hip are indications of anchoring and availability. These are the two most frequent cognitive biases in the emergency department, and often they are all a doctor needs to hit the mark, to make a correct diagnosis and recommend an effective therapy. But they also can veer wide of the mark. So, a fair question to ask an ER physician is, what's the worst thing this can be? That question is not a sign of neurosis or hypochondria. In fact, residents are trained to keep it in mind with each patient they see. But it can easily slip from the forefront of thinking in the intense environment of emergency care. By asking that question, a patient, friend, or family member can slow down the doctor's pace and help him think more broadly. You can prompt him to consider lifting his anchor from the most available harbor. You might also cause the rare doctor who is acting out of pique, like the resident we just saw, to stop in his tracks and revert to a professional form of behavior. Twice in Pat Cross-Carry's career, he made a dazzling diagnosis in the emergency department. In each instance, a triage nurse had diagnosed a middle-aged man with a kidney stone. It was a fair first assessment. The usual hallmarks were present: the onset of acute pain in the flank, so severe that the patient vomited, followed by blood in the urine. Treatment with painkillers and intravenous fluids until the stone passes is almost always successful. But Cross-Carry recalled the importance of the worst-case scenario. "I found that it wasn't a kidney stone at all," he told me, "but a dissecting abdominal aortic aneurysm." The aorta, the large vessel that carries blood from the heart through the chest and into the abdomen, had a tear on one side, accounting for the acute pain. Blood was leaking through the vessel into the kidney and being passed in the urine. Cross-Carry told me he didn't think the diagnosis was brilliant at all. But I felt otherwise. I imagined myself not in relaxed conversation with him, but in the midst of evaluating 4 or 5 sick people at once under all the stresses of the ER environment. Another way that laypeople can focus a doctor's attention is to ask, "What body parts are near where I am having my symptom?" This sounds elementary, but this query can help avoid yin-yang-out errors. "Yes, I know that I have irritable bowel syndrome," Maxine Carlson might have said, "and that I've been here many times and been told that it's my chronic condition." But if the pain is something new, on top of that long-standing problem, what body part might be causing the symptom? Enumerating the tissues and organs in the lower abdomen could have steered the discussion to the reproductive tract, and then on to recent intercourse and missed periods. It may seem presumptuous to expect a patient short of breath like Blanche Begay, or in pain like Maxine Carlson, to help a doctor think. But what we say to a physician, and how we say it, sculpts his thinking. That includes not only our answers, but our questions. Chapter 4. Gatekeepers. Imagine watching a train go by. You are looking for one face in the window. Car after car passes. If you become distracted or inattentive, you risk missing the person. Or if the train picks up too much speed, the faces begin to blur, and you can't see the one you are seeking. That's what primary care medicine is like, Victoria Rogers McAvoy told me. McAvoy is a tall, lean woman in her 50s with short-cropped blonde hair and steady eyes. She practices general pediatrics in a town west of Boston. It's much harder than the proverbial needle in a haystack, because the haystack is not moving. Each day there is a steady flow of children before your eyes. You are doing well baby checks, examinations for school, making sure each one is up to date on his vaccinations. It can become rote, and you stop observing closely. Then you have the endless number of kids who are cranky and have a fever, and it's almost always a virus or a strep throat. They can all blur. But then there is that one time it's meningitis. The blessing of pediatrics, but also its curse, is that almost all of the children who come to the office turn out to be healthy or have a minor problem, McAvoy elaborated. A blessing, of course, that the kids are fine, but a curse because you can become lulled by the monotony of the mundane. With that in mind, she asks herself one pivotal question each time she sees a child. In essence, the same question Pat Crosscarry and Harrison Alter ask about each patient in the ER. Does he or she have a serious problem? Every pediatrician should consider that as soon as the child comes into the room. And because many of the patients are infants and toddlers who can't communicate what they are feeling, your powers of observation have to be particularly acute. Essentially, the doctor gets all of the information from the parents, which means she has to consider both the parents' degree of familiarity with their child and their subconscious or emotional reaction to the possibility that something is wrong. This reaction can be extreme. Some parents deny the existence of a serious problem. Others exaggerate what is normal because of their anxiety. Parents have reported that their child was lethargic and not eating, information that would trigger a high level of concern in the doctor. But with one glance, she would see the child playing happily on the examining table and grinning. The story was completely overblown, and you knew immediately that the kid was not seriously sick. Then there was the corollary, where a mother said that her baby felt a little warm, but was otherwise okay. McAvoy was stunned to see the child breathing rapidly and lying limp in the mother's arms. The child had pneumonia. McAvoy, like all pediatricians, looks for certain key features. Does the child smile, play with toys, actively walk or crawl? Or is she passive, not resisting when a foreign instrument like a stethoscope is placed on her chest? Pattern recognition in pediatrics begins with behavior. And the art of pediatrics, then, is to further study the child while simultaneously interpreting what the parents report. This melding of data, McAvoy said, is not a skill set that comes from a textbook, because it requires a level of self-awareness by the doctor about his own feelings toward the family. While first impressions are often right, you have to be careful and always doubt your initial response. It's a foolish pediatrician who does not listen closely to the parents and take seriously what they are saying, McAvoy said. But you need to filter what they say with the child's condition. I told her the story of my first child, Stephen. My wife, Pam, and I had returned from living in California to the East Coast. It was the July 4th weekend, and we stopped in Connecticut to visit her parents. Stephen was then 9 months old, and had been irritable and not feeding well during the cross-country flight. When we arrived at Pam's parents' house, he was restless in the crib and then had a dark, malodorous stool that was different from his usual bowel movements. We took him to an older pediatrician in town. The doctor glanced at Steve and quickly dismissed Pam's worries that he was seriously ill. "You're over-anxious, a first-time mother," the pediatrician told her. "Doctor parents are like this." By the time we arrived in Boston, Steve was grunting and drawing his legs up to his chest. We rushed him to the emergency room of the Boston Children's Hospital. He had an intestinal obstruction requiring urgent surgery. Pam and I could only conclude that, despite his many years in practice, the pediatrician in Connecticut had made a snap judgment that Pam was neurotic about her firstborn, not a reliable reporter of a meaningful change in her baby's behavior and condition. The pediatrician in Connecticut watched the train go by, hour after hour, day after day, year after year after year. I asked McAvoy, who had also been in practice for decades, "How do you keep your eyelids open?" "I prepare myself mentally before each session," she replied, just as she used to prepare herself mentally before a competitive tennis match. In 1968, when she was in college, McAvoy was ranked third in the nation in tennis and played at Wimbledon. As an athlete, she learned to focus her mind, to anticipate the unexpected spin, and not to be lulled into complacency despite her expertise. "But beyond the skills from sports, you simply have to control the volume," she said. And the truth is that most pediatricians stay afloat by seeing large numbers of children each day. Before McAvoy took her current job, she worked in a busy group practice in another Boston suburb. At the time, she had four children of her own at home. She spent each day tending to dozens of patients and their parents. "But it was the night call that was killing me," she said. She was paged every 20 or 30 minutes, and the calls continued into the next morning. If there was serious concern based on the telephone contact, then McAvoy returned to the office and saw the child regardless of the hour. "After doing this for a few hours, I was beginning to burn out. I just couldn't stand it." McAvoy found herself becoming irritable and bitter. "I was so exhausted from this brutal schedule that at times I said things to parents that were curt and sharp, and later